The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway again. Back inside the Beltway. My thanks to Bruce Hooley for sitting in for me yesterday. I had been in Oklahoma City on Monday night and Tuesday and flew back yesterday in Oklahoma City to speak to the Christian Employers Alliance. They are a group of Christian employers who have banded together, hundreds of them, to become an umbrella group for litigation against onerous government mandates against any kind of masterpiece cake shop shutdown of a business owned by a Christian. I was happy to speak to them. I think they had to grow by leaps and bounds. They have some benefit programs, of course, like any good association, but they exist to provide an umbrella for all Christian employers in the United States who fear that the administrative state is getting too big and is crowding them out, and it is, and so they're acting. Go look up Christian Employers Alliance and join it. While I was gone, Bruce Hooley sat in for me from Columbus, and I am told he did a fine, wonderful, extraordinary job, as one would expect of a pro like Bruce and a Clevelander and a Buckeye. And so it was seamless when it came to the Browns and the Buckeyes. I don't know if he got into Cavaliers and Indians, now Guardians, but Bruce is a good guest host. I've got two guest hosts in Ohio, Bob France and Bruce Hooley now. So I've got the bench with Ed Morrissey and Mark Davis and Kurt Schlichter. We've got like five people on the bench, always ready to stand up. Of course, there's also always Generalissimo, but he's grumpy this morning, so I'm not going to bring him on. I am, however, going to bring on the President of the United States because I looked at my cut sheet this morning and I saw he had been at WKRP Cincinnati. And I said, that's not true. Dwayne is attempting to joke with me, WKRP in Cincinnati. Then I looked more closely, and it was WKRC in Cincinnati. WKRC and Steve Steve Inskeep. Sorry, Steve, you're a mature broadcaster at NPR. Kyle Inskeep is a young broadcaster with WKRC in Cincinnati. He is from Butler, so I really don't know what to expect from this. The Butler Beagles have one of their own behind the desk in Cincinnati. And so Joe Biden, for whatever reason, got together with WKRC of Cincinnati's Kyle Inskeep. Cut number three.
I don't think presidents should be deciding what to do about. Look, a lot of people are worried. Think about this. Look, what 750,000 people have died because of COVID. 750,000 people. The psychological scars that has put on so many people. Schools have not been open because of COVID, and they're just getting open again. We're in a situation where there's a lot of anxiety. Gas prices are up exceedingly high. They've been up this high before, but not recently. Gas price. That's why I have the Attorney General taking a look at whether or not these gas companies are gouging people, because although the price of oil is coming down some, the price of gas hadn't come down some. So there's a lot of things that have people that are really a great deal of anxiety, a great deal of concern. And they all relate to, even though we've created almost 6 million jobs since I came into office, we're in a situation where they don't feel it right now. They don't feel it.
So why do you think the president is talking with WKRP in Cincinnati? Actually, WKRC in Cincinnati. Why is the president of all of the places in the country decided he's going to talk with Kyle Inskeep, who is a Butler Beagle and graduated magna cum laude from Butler? I'm looking at this. He worked for NBC News. He was the Russert Fellow, so that means he's a pretty smart guy. He wasn't a Russert Fellow when I've been at NBC, and he does the 5, 6, and 11 newscaps with Paula Todi at WKRC Cincinnati. If I had a production team, we would have the song ready when we went out. Joe Biden went on further with Kyle Inskeep at WKRC in Cincinnati. Cut number four.
want to turn to your polling really quickly here. The latest polling from USA Today has your approval rating at 38%. A new CNN poll shows 58% of Americans believe that you aren't paying enough attention to the nation's most important issue. So I'm wondering, when you combine that with the election results that we saw last week, is this giving you kind of a sign that maybe you need to recalibrate some of your administration's priorities as you approach that one-year mark in office?
Well, look, the poll I saw just before I walked in on another station was my polling number is down, but it's 48% to 52%. But look, the point is, I didn't run because of the polls. I think what you're going to see is the combination of what I did in the beginning in terms of the Recovery Act and then and this legislation, as well as the legislation that we're about to pass, God willing, on what's called Build Back Better, everything from child care to funding 3 and 4 year olds in school, et cetera. I think all that's going to have a significant impact on ordinary Americans, like the households I came from, that in fact are going to change their circumstance and result in essentially tax cuts for the child care they'll get, tax cuts for being able to send their kids to 3 and 4 years old to school that they otherwise have to pay for it. So there's a whole lot of things that are going to be happening. I think this is an up and down, an up and down circumstance. And as I looked at the poll, data literally as I was walking out of the office after doing another thing I had to do, is my polling numbers are the same, essentially what everyone from Bush to Clinton to, all of Obama were at the same time.
So why is the president doing local media hits from the White House with WKRC in Cincinnati? Why is he? Because the youngsters at WKRC in Cincinnati are tossing him underhand and letting him talk for a minute and a half and not making any sense. Other news, the Senate is got their carving knives out. If the House Democrats can agree on a $2 trillion spending plan, it's going to get sent over for surgery to the Senate, going to dump out the environmental provisions, going to dump out the paid family leave, going to dump out the state and local tax cap repeal. It's really a placeholder. I think they realized that they got had. The progressives were completely had. Bravo to the UAE. The UAE has flown out the Afghanistan pilots who escaped from Afghanistan to Tajikistan with their planes. And the UAE has gotten them to the UAE, got them out of Tajikistan on their way to freedom. A judge in Washington, D.C. has rejected President Trump's claims of executive privilege. And so his papers are ordered to be turned over to the January 6th Commission. I expect that one will go to the D.C. Circuit and then the Supreme Court. Don't work up too much about it. The Washington Post has a story. Death threats, online abuse, police protection. School board members face dark new reality. Now, I've been counseling school board members for 30 years since the Orange County School Board went bankrupt. I had a friend on it. I had two friends on it, in fact. And school boards are often rocky, and often parents show up and they yell at the school board members, and this is part of the deal. If you run for the school board, you're going to get yelled at. Now, right now, we've got a media attempting to try and prove that CRT isn't real and that the quarantine has gone along smoothly and that the teacher unions are in favor of children. And so parents are frustrated that they don't actually, some school boards don't actually seem to know what's going on. And those that do have been gliding along on the easy path of going along with the union. And now they find that the parents are not so happy about the shutdown and especially about the quarantine rules and especially about masking K-3 year olds and K-3 third graders. And after last year's complete shutdown, parents have had it with school boards. So, yes, there are a lot of unhappy parents. But here's the deal. You don't have to be on a school board. You can always resign. I don't believe in threats of violence. I don't believe in intimidation. I do believe that the public gets to yell at elected officials. And I've been yelled at a lot in my many years on various different boards, including the Children and Families Commission, including especially the Air Quality Management District when I was on the South Coast Air Quality Management District. Didn't get yelled at much for the California Arts Council. Got yelled at a lot when I was at OPM as its general counsel, deputy director, and its director. And in the radio business, you get yelled at all the time. I mean, Dwayne yells at me every day. So if you don't like getting yelled at, just resign from the school board. They'll understand. They'll find somebody else out there. Moderna and the U.S. are arguing over patents, which proves that it's valuable and it works. Way to go. Operation Warp Speed. Pfizer is going to ask the FDA to expand the COVID-19 booster shots to all adults, which is what that should have been months ago. I'm talking to Andy Slava today on his podcast. This is one of the many mistakes made by the CDC and the FDA, is rolling out the booster a little bit here, a little bit there, instead of saying, everybody go get the booster, which is what you ought to do. If you're eligible for the booster, go and get it. Looks like we're going to have annual boosters for the rest of our days when it comes to COVID-19 until the body develops an endemic response to it, an endemic disease. But in the meantime, it's going to be like the flu shot, and we're going to get it. And that's okay. It's not the end of the world. And we've got to move beyond masks and shutdowns, because the pandemic has now become endemic. And we'll talk more about vaccine mandates when I come back after the break on this Wednesday edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Ilhan Omar gave a Zoom press call yesterday, which I find fascinating. Cut number 16.
The largest fossil fuel producers must pay for their past greenhouse gas emissions, which could raise at least $500 billion alone.
So you see, if you ever emitted, Ilhan Omar wants all of your money. That's the bottom line there. Joined now by Michael Oren, former ambassador of Israel to the United States, now writing in a number of publications about Iran's approach to the threshold. Good morning, Ambassador Oren. How are you?
I'm great, Hugh. Good to be with you, as always.
I have read some notes of yours where you are going to make it very, very clear Israel cannot live with a threshold nuclear power, and Joe Biden seems intent on persuading Americans that that's not a problem. Would you explain?
Okay. It's a hard argument to make, and I'm trying to make it to American audiences, but it's very technical. So let's make it as simple as possible. Iran is approaching threshold capacity. That means the ability to make a bomb within a matter of weeks or even a matter of days. You got it all. You got the enriched uranium that's enriched to weapons grade, about 90% enrichment. You may have a delivery system. They have an intercontinental ballistic system that can reach Central Europe today. It can probably reach Paris. Another 10 years, it'll reach Washington, D.C. And they probably have a warhead program. We know that they have the warhead program from the nuclear archive that our Mossad agents stole from Tehran several years back. They have all the components. Now, the United States can say, listen, Iran will never get a bomb on our watch. Okay, they won't have the bomb, but they may have the ability to get a bomb in short order. Now, for Israel, that is completely intolerable. Because every time we go to war against Hezbollah or Hamas, these are Iranian proxies, we have to take into consideration the possibility that our actions may precipitate an Iranian breakout to make a bomb. So it becomes a tremendous, tremendous restriction on our maneuverability. We have to take that into consideration all the time, which is why Foreign Minister Lapid, who was visiting Washington recently with Secretary of State Blinken, made it clear that Israel cannot live with a threshold capacity. Secretary of State Blinken said the United States will not allow Iran to get a bomb. He didn't say Iran wouldn't let Iran not have the ability to have a bomb. In our professional world, it's sometimes referred to as Japan-like capabilities. Japan has the ability to make a bomb very quickly. But, you know, Japan's not Iran. Iran's not Japan. Iran's not threatening to wipe another country off the map, i.e. Israel. Iran's not the world's largest state sponsor of terrorism and shooting rockets at American bases in Iraq.
The idea of threshold capacity, Dr. Oren, I've tried to explain to people as being the bartender in every bar fight scene reaches underneath the bar and pulls out a shotgun, which is threshold capacity the moment it comes above the bar. And so when you get into a fight with Hezbollah or Hamas, threshold capacity is Israel reaches underneath the bar and comes up with a nuclear weapon. That's unacceptable.
Iran does, yeah.
Iran does.
That's just it. And that becomes a huge check on our ability to defend ourselves.
So what would it take to remove threshold capacity?
You've got to put tremendous, tremendous sanctions on Iran, punishing sanctions on Iran.
Or
that, you know, right now they're enriching to 60%. This gets really technical because under the JCPOA of 2015, they're allowed to enrich to 3.4%.
Yes.
The distance between 3.4% and 20% is a lot longer than the distance between 20% and 60%, which is where they are now. And it's between 60% and 90%, which is weapons grade, is nothing. It's a matter of weeks.
And they can't, they actually can't go back.
More advanced centrifuges.
Yeah.
One of the crazy things about the JCPOA, it doesn't prevent Iran from developing advanced centrifuges that can enrich at twice or even six times the current at the rate of 2015. So you put these centrifuges in, they're going to enrich uranium up to 90% in a matter of days.
So it was a terrible deal. A terrible deal, and now you have to do something about it. The Biden administration is not going to do something about it, but I think what you're preparing people for is that Israel is going to have to attack Iran fairly soon.
We have to prepare for the world for the fact that Israel is going to have to defend itself. If Iran approaches the threshold capacity, we cannot coexist with that, period.
And so what's that look like? You know, we might do this 20 times, Michael. We might go over this 20 times in the next 20 weeks. What does it look like? What will people wake up and find has happened?
Well, I can't go into, you know, operational details, and frankly, I don't know all the operational details, but we have the ability to defend ourselves against Iran. Now, we don't have the ability that the United States has. Clearly, we don't have strategic bombers, but we do have capabilities. And I believe that we can stop Iran from reaching threshold capacity.
But isn't that a targeting problem of dozens of facilities?
It is vastly more complicated than the Iraqi nuclear facility that was taken out by Israeli planes in 1981. The Syrian nuclear facility was taken out by Israeli planes in 2007. It is with a much, much bigger country, Iran. It's further away from Israel. And yes, it's a nuclear program. It's like an archipelago. Right? It's not a single island. And yes, we have to figure out ways that we can stop the process by hitting sort of vital junctures in that system.
But once you start to do that, what you want redundancy in the stoppage. So you don't hit five on the hope that five is enough. You hit 25 or you hit 125, and then Iran threatens war, and that's where the United States has to step up to protect
Iran
its ally.
Iran doesn't have the ability to make war on anybody. Iran doesn't have an air force. Iran doesn't have a tank force. Iran cannot.
I think that's important for people to know. Iran is a paper tiger, but they're trying to get the nuclear weapon that makes them a very unpaper tiger. Michael Oren, follow him on Twitter at Dr. Michael Oren. Dr. Michael Oren, always a pleasure. Follow me to hour number two of this Wednesday morning Hugh Hewitt Show. Brought to you by ReliefFactor.com. $19.95 gets you started on ReliefFactor.com. I talk about it three times in my daily show. At the bottom of the first hour when I take it, and then in hours two and three when I remind you to take it, depending on when your commute begins, because ReliefFactor.com works. It's the only supplement I've taken in 30 years of broadcasting. I've declined every other opportunity to take a supplement, and I'll tell you why. Because ReliefFactor.com actually works. I carry in curcumin and resveratrol omega, temporary relief for the relief of minor aches and pains, temporary support for the relief of minor aches and pains, and you can't do better than that three-week starter pack, $19.95. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt, joined by Congressman Mike Gallagher of the great state of Wisconsin. Congressman, why aren't you at COP26 with Nancy Pelosi and the rest of the Democrats who went with her?
Hey, as soon as they agree to make nuclear and nuclear microreactor technology a key part of the climate change solution, then I'll have a discussion about going with Nancy to COP26. But thus far, I have seen no such common sense plank as part of the Democrats' climate change agenda.
It remains the greatest unsolved riddle is how they intend to get to zero emissions without nuclear power. It cannot be done, and yet they are caught between the anti-nuke cultists in their own party and the climate change cultists in their own party, Congressman. So what did they promise? This is President Obama yesterday. I wanted you to hear this at the COP26, cut number 18.
U.S. with a higher per capita carbon footprint does have to do more than a country like Mali or Bangladesh. It's also why we need to make sure the people most affected by the transition to clean energy aren't the ones bearing most of the cost. They don't have any margin for error. I can afford to give up a lot of my current lifestyle to benefit the planet.
All right, so Congressman Gallagher, I'd like some hearings when you're in the majority next year on what President Obama has given up of his current lifestyle. Because I actually think the house on Martha's Vineyard isn't going to go, nor the Kalorama Mansion, nor the Obama Presidential Palace in Chicago. I just don't think any of it's really on the cutting block.
I highly doubt it. And I think this is a great example of what we've seen time and again from Democratic elites, which is, you know, rules for thee, but not for me. Right. We saw that with Obama's birthday party in a different context with COVID. But You see it with all these people who don't want to give up their private jets and their lavish lifestyle, but want to impose draconian and extremely costly policies upon the American people. And make no mistake, your average American who doesn't live the lifestyle that former President Barack Obama does is hurting right now from increased energy prices and is thinking about how to pay their energy bill at the end of the month. And what we saw from really the first day of the Biden administration with the canceling of the Keystone Pipeline and thereby giving a massive geopolitical gift to Russia, we've seen with this Green New Deal agenda, part of which was instantiated into law with the infrastructure bill, an agenda that's hostile to domestic energy production in the United States, is a policy that is hurting everyday Americans and helping America's greatest enemies. And this idea that we're somehow going to get a massive climate agreement that includes China, which is the world's worst environmental actor, is a complete fantasy that John Kerry tells himself before he goes to bed in his mansion. It's not going to happen. Eventually, China will diversify their energy sector for energy security reasons, but it's not going to be because of anything we told them. And by the way, they are investing heavily.
Oh, I was about to say.
Technology.
Yeah, they are exporting microtechnology nuclear reactors all over the world, and they're building them at home. Speaking of China, Gerald Seeb in the Wall Street Journal, while America feuds at home, Russia and China are busy making moves, and Walter Russell Mead in the Wall Street Journal, Xi Jinping battens down the hatches. They're both talking about Xi's consolidation of power and his indifference to the West. And I mean, it's very pronounced, not only at COP26, but at the G20, which he disdained to attend. And he's simply laughing at us now, Mike Gallagher.
100%. Well, right now the sixth plenum is going on. And really the theme of this is the complete consolidation of Xi Jinping's power and his elevation to a level of leadership not seen since Mao. And a rewriting of the party's history to really frame it in three distinct eras, one covering the period of the PRC's founding to Mao's death, the other the period of Deng Xiaoping's reforms, and now Xi Jinping's so-called new era and his era of national rejuvenation. And this is important to understand because, of course, once in early next year, when Xi, after pocketing the propaganda victory of the Olympics, is able to get a third term as General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, the last thing on his agenda to really establish himself as the third paramount leader in Chinese history is the reunification of Taiwan with the mainland. So what we saw this week with the Chinese conducting drills involving highly detailed mock-ups of American aircraft carriers in the desert, what we've seen with their massive increase in nuclear silos, what we've seen with their general increased aggression across the board. They just did some flights near Taiwan when there was a congressional delegation on hand, is, I think, an effort to prepare for the reunification of Taiwan with the mainland by force if necessary. And meanwhile, we are sleepwalking towards disaster. On the current course, we will lose World War III before it begins, either through preemptive surrender or through battlefield defeat if we don't change course immediately. And thus far, I have not seen any signs in the Biden administration that they're willing to tackle this with a sense of urgency and creativity that it demands.
No, and I don't think you're going to. I want to play you a little excerpt of President Biden yesterday on not WKRP in Cincinnati. You're too young to remember WKRP in Cincinnati. That was a sitcom in the 70s. But WKRC in Cincinnati. He's really going into the, you know, I actually think that Kyle Inskeep did a fine job for a local anchor from Butler. And it's really remarkable that a Butler grad is, I didn't even know they were a degree granting institution, but he got Joe Biden. Here's what the president had to say. Cut number three.
I don't think presidents should be deciding what to do about, look, a lot of people are worried. Think about this. Look what 750,000 people have died because of COVID. 750,000 people. The psychological scars that has put on so many people. Schools have not been open because of COVID, and they're just getting open again. We're in a situation where there's a lot of anxiety. Gas prices are up exceedingly high. They've been up this high before, but not recently. Gas price. That's why I have the Attorney General taking a look at whether or not these gas companies are gouging people because although the price of oil is coming down some, the price of gas hadn't come down some. So there's a lot of things that have people that are really a great deal of anxiety, a great deal of concern. And they all relate to, even though we've created almost 6 million jobs since I came into office, we're in a situation where people don't, I mean, they don't feel it right now. They don't feel it.
So Mike Gallagher, then he looks at the camera and the poor guy goes on to a different subject. What did you make of that tour of America from your President Joe Biden and my President Joe Biden on WKRC in Cincinnati?
I mean, it's totally nonsensical. I mean, with all due respect to the president, I mean, it does not inspire one iota of confidence. Clearly, he has lost a massive step, much like the Browns in that respect, Hugh.
No, we beat the Bengals. We beat the Bengals, and we are back. OBJ, we wish him well, but we had the best offense in the league last week. I guess you didn't notice that. I guess there were other problems in Green Bay, which I were going to admit out of courtesy. I wasn't going to bring those up, but be careful. If you bring up the Browns, everything's on the table.
I know. Here's the thing, Hugh. If the president is focusing on the death of Americans from COVID, the massive toll in terms of learning loss from education, school shutdowns, just the overall cost, trillions of dollars spent, then where is the outrage with respect to the cover-up perpetrated by the Chinese Communist Party? Why not demand that your intelligence community, on which you spend over $80 billion a year, do better than a 90-day intelligence review that comes back and effectively says, well, you know what, we don't know what's going on, and we're unlikely to know unless we get the cooperation of the Chinese Communist Party. No way. That is totally
they don't want to know.
Bogus.
They don't want to know.
The other thing, and there was a great Bloomberg report on this yesterday or early today, we are now realizing the cost of 2 decades of having our intel networks, particularly our human intelligence networks in China, completely compromised and not really focusing on certain collection targets in China. And I think all Americans should be outraged by the cost that this pandemic has taken on their lives and should demand a fulsome answer into how it started and whether U.S. taxpayer dollars played a role in funding gain-of-function research at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, as now it seems even the NIH has been forced to admit because of FOIA requests by The Intercept and congressional pressure, even though Fauci himself continues to dissemble on the very subject. So if the president's worried about the cost of COVID and the anxiety it's produced, then he darn well better do better when it comes to investigating how this thing started and holding the Chinese Communist Party responsible for its cover-up that cost us millions of lives.
I'm telling you right now, if you're counting on the president doing better than he did yesterday at WKRC in Cincinnati, not going to happen. I do want to ask you about the Washington Post. You live close to the ground in Wisconsin. Death threats, online abuse, police protection. School board members face dark new reality. I understand there are a couple of school boards in the United States where violence has been threatened, and that is inimical to the American way of life. But I've been doing school board meetings for 30 years, and I've helped school board members before, and I've served on advisory committees, and parents sometimes get upset and they yell, and I'm sure you've been yelled at, and if you don't want to be yelled at, get off the school board, because that's part of the job, Mike Gallagher.
100%. Parents are upset, not only because of the recent injection of critical race theory into K-12 curriculum in some school districts, but also because for decades now, public education in America has been sliding slowly and steadily into mediocrity. In my home state of Wisconsin, where we used to rank top five in education consistently, where we started the school choice movement, where we have a proud educational legacy, we have 60% of kids that can't read at grade level. And if you can't read at grade level by third grade, let alone by eighth grade, statistically, it is very difficult for you to succeed. Now is the moment, particularly after Virginia, for Republicans to seize the mantle of education reform, to think even beyond school choice, the next level of choice, true educational reform. This is an issue that affects every family
in America, Democrat, Republican, Independent. And the fact that parents are upset does not suggest that they are domestic terrorists, as the DOJ might have you believe. It merely suggests that they want their kids to learn how to read, write, and succeed and become 18-year-olds that are capable of surviving in a very difficult and challenging economic environment. We need to be the party that offers them a solution that prepares kids to be able to work and thrive in the 21st century.
And I think that is the Virginia plan. We'll watch Youngkin, Glenn Youngkin, as he unfolds that. But I love the fact that, in the meantime, worried about school board members are getting yelled at by parents who are frustrated that schools have been closed for a year and a half. Congressman Mike Gallagher. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. It's Wednesday Inside the Beltway, and I'm joined by Brian Westbury of First Trust Portfolio, our favorite economist. Good morning, Brian. How are you?
Hey, Hugh. I am well. I'm in Hillsdale, Michigan today. So.
Oh, wonderful. Are you talking to the undergraduates at Hillsdale College?
Well, no, actually, they have their CCA four-time-a-year meeting of supporters, interested citizens, donors, and students. So I was the they had speakers over a 3-day period, and I closed it out with talking about the alternative to the Great Reset.
Oh, very good. I look forward to watching that. I'm sure they'll post it at hillsdale.edu. Brian, I have one question for you this morning. We passed an additional $500 billion in spending this week. A half trillion had already been spent, and then we repurposed $500 billion. So it's $1 trillion of more spending. But the 10-year treasury dropped down to 1.432%. Why?
Yeah, you know what, Hugh? The reason, well, that's what you asked, it wasn't the spending. It was all about the fact that the White House is interviewing Lyle Brainard to take the place of Jerome Powell, as the Federal Reserve Board chairman. What's interesting about inflation, which we all know is here and getting worse, is that initially when the Fed causes it by holding interest rates down, you get fooled. All right, it's sort of like if you have a car accident and they give you morphine, you don't really know how badly you're hurt. And this is what happens when the Federal Reserve holds interest rates down artificially. And so if they take Powell out and put in a new chairman and we have more resignations, which we've already had a couple of people who are willing to raise interest rates, then the Fed is going to hold rates lower longer, which means the bond market rallies. And that's exactly what we saw. Everybody is saying, oh, the Fed is never going to tighten monetary policy. We all know they have to eventually, but if they stretch it out, the longer they stretch it out, the lower they hold interest rates for a longer period of time.
Do you remember William Miller, the Secretary of the Treasury, I believe, under Jimmy Carter?
Yeah.
And didn't he do the same thing that eventually had to be reversed by Volcker, which is ignore the reality of printing money?
Yeah, absolutely. Arthur Burns. And what we did is we actually went back, and this is very, very well documented, that Richard Nixon leaned on the Fed politically. And the Federal Reserve is supposed to be independent of the political the Congress, of the White House, of any political influence. And yet we know over time that there are periods where it wasn't. And one of those was the 1970s. And here's my belief. I believe the minute Jerome Powell, who's the current chairman, gave a speech and said, it is time to stop buying so many bonds and eventually we're going to have to raise interest rates, I thought he signed his death warrant at that point. And so it's not surprising to see the White House interviewing other people. We talk about the Fed as being hawkish. They're willing to raise rates, or dovish. They're willing to keep rates lower or even lower them. and the Fed is turning more dovish.
And so when do they have to make a decision by on the Fed chairman?
Yeah, they, Jerome Powell's term ends in January. Usually by now, you would have had somebody named, and then they have to face Senate confirmation. So they have to nominate somebody, and then they have to be voted through the Senate. I don't see why anybody on the list right now would have a hard time getting through. There might be something in the background, or who knows what.
What's the bottom line if they toss out January. If they toss out Powell and we go to easy money? What does that do to the market? I mean, does that just keep the inflationary spiral? I remember you in Atlanta saying, "Don't sell your stocks for 10 months." Does that become 2 years?
Yeah, well, it might be. The interest rate is the discount rate. The higher it is, the less future earnings are worth. So the Fed, by artificially holding down rates, they're going to cause us problems by giving us inflation. But in the near term, they're going to prop up the value of assets and as a result, the stock market as well.
Wow. I bet there will be a hangover. There always is, Brian, right?
Yeah, this is like using morphine after a car accident. And some people get addicted, and that's how you end up with stagflation, because they never tighten, and it goes on for a decade. And so, you know, monetary policy isn't that hard. Just stop printing money.
And there's always a bill that has to be picked up, usually by the last person in the bar or the restaurant, which would be the American taxpayer. Brian Westbury, follow him on Twitter at Westbury. Thank you. Follow me to hour number three, America. Al Mohler, president of the Southern Theological Seminary, joins me next on The Hugh Hewitt Show. Hi, it's Hugh Hewitt for Birch Gold. If you found yourself completely befuddled by events in Afghanistan, alarmed about inflation and otherwise uneasy, well, about everything, about Americans standing in the world, about what comes next, then you're feeling like everybody else is, and uncertainty is usually a time that you want to increase your holdings in gold. When I do that, I do it with Birch Gold. I buy my gold from Birch Gold. You can go to HughGold.com or text my name, Hugh, H-U-G-H, to 474747. They will send you free information. If you want to roll over a portion of your IRA or your 401k into physical precious metals, Birch Gold is who to do that with. They have an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau, countless five-star reviews, thousands of happy customers. If you're thinking, I got to get some gold, do it with Birch Gold via HughGold.com or text my name, Hugh, to 474747. That's Hugh to 474747 or HughGold.com.
Good morning, Glory America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt live inside the Beltway. And this morning, the question of vaccine mandates is on the table. I'm joined by my old friend, Dr. Albert Mohler, who is the president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, and Ryan Bangert, senior counsel for the Alliance Defending Freedom. They are together in court. Dr. Mohler, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hugh, it's always great to be with you. Thank you.
I want you to set up for people the beginning, what Southern Baptist Theological Seminary is, what it does, how many people study there, and how many people you employ before we go to the mandate the federal government is attempting to foist onto you.
Yeah, thank you, Hugh. We are the largest and one of the oldest theological seminaries in the United States. Our primary task is the training of ministers of the gospel. And so we're training right now about 6,000 ministers in training to serve in churches. That's our essential mission. It's been that way since 1859.
Now, the Baptists are legendary in the United States because they are very suspicious of government. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, it's a fair statement because, as you know, Baptists had to be some of the earliest defenders of religious liberty in this country in the period before our constitutional agreement.
Yeah, and so they did that. They did that with Madison. They did that with Jefferson. They did that with the Danbury Baptists. So there's a long tradition of Baptists believing in religious liberty. So what did the federal government tell you to do, Dr. Mohler, and why did you get Ryan and the ADF involved?
Well, we had heard about what the Biden vaccine mandate was likely to be. The president had made the comments. Members of his administration had made comments.
And what was clear was that the purpose of the administration was to transform employers into agents of the state, basically arms of the administrative state. And in this case, when you're talking about a religious employer, you're talking about very dangerous territory. And by the time the rule was finally promulgated and we saw what it was, this would indeed turn a religious institution into a coercive arm of the government. And that is just a precedent that that no religious institution should allow.
Now, I spoke on Tuesday night to the Religious Employers Alliance about this. And my position on vaccines is great that they're here. I've been vaccinated. I've had a booster. I think you agree with me, Al, right? Vaccinations are a very good thing. And I'm all for people getting vaccinated.
I've had three.
Yeah, you and me both. We're in the same group. And God bless everyone out there who is getting a vaccination, who's checked and figured it out. But Ryan Bangert, that's different completely from telling me or Al that I've got to go and vaccinate my employees. Would you explain that to people?
That's exactly right, Hugh. This lawsuit is not about the wisdom or the efficacy of vaccines as vaccines. Rather, it's a question. It poses a question. Does the federal government have the writ to do what it has done? Does it have the power under the U.S. Constitution to force employers to become the vaccine commissars for the federal government and force their employees to receive vaccines that may violate their conscientious beliefs? That's the question. It's a question of government power. And we don't believe, and I think the Constitution is clear, that it never empowered the federal government to mandate private employers, especially religious seminaries, to get involved with and compel their employees to receive a vaccine.
No, I'm going to put aside the issue of state and local authority for a moment, Ryan. I want to stick with the federal authority, which is a government of limited and enumerated powers. And I like to point out that when they attempted to impress local law enforcement officers into gun laws, the Supreme Court rebuked them in Prince versus the United States and said, no, federal government, you don't get to make state authorities do your bidding. Isn't the same principle applicable and indeed more applicable to the private sector than it would be to the state governments?
Absolutely. And in fact, we're talking about the Commerce Clause powers now of the United States government. And the Commerce Clause gives the government the power to regulate commerce amongst the states. There's really no connection between commercial activity and forcing private religious employers to compel their employees to receive a vaccine. In fact, in the Sebelius case, the Supreme Court was very skeptical that the federal government had the power to compel people to purchase health insurance. This seems like a bridge even beyond that.
It is. Now, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act will come into play here as well. I am curious if before the Sixth Circuit you're arguing free exercise or if you're arguing RFRA or if you're arguing both.
We're arguing both, Hugh, and I think that's very important because the Religious Freedom Restoration Act requires the government to articulate a compelling interest and narrowly tailor its solution when it's you're compelling someone to violate their religious beliefs. And here, it's very clear that SVTS has a religious belief against compelling its employees to violate their conscience. And it would be completely inconsistent with RFRA for the government to exercise that kind of power, especially when you look at the vaccination rates that are out right now. Almost 80% of adults have vaccinations. We have now therapies that are highly effective at treating COVID. So there's really no way the government can say with a straight face that this mandate is narrowly tailored to advance any kind of compelling government interest.
So, Dr. Mohler, later today I'm going to do a podcast with Andy Slavitt, who was President Obama's number two on vaccines, because he knows I agree with vaccination generally. He knows I've been a prophet for getting vaccinated. But I'm going to have to explain to him why this doesn't make any sense and why it is deeply offensive and indeed dangerous. What would you say to him?
Well, the first thing I would say is that when you're talking about a mandate and you are talking about an issue on which there's a legitimate, genuine, religious difference of opinion, it's very dangerous for the federal government to become involved in this in any way. But the particular way that the government has decided to do this, the mechanism it has chosen, is to use employers as the instruments of its will. And when that employer is a religious employer, every single alarm bell we know should go off in terms of religious liberty and in terms of the danger of state power. If the government wants to do this, you know, it would have mechanisms to do it that would be at least free from this onerous complication, which I believe is blatantly unconstitutional. Now, whether it should or not is a different question. But the way that the Biden administration has chosen to promulgate and to apply this rule is a direct subversion of religious liberty of a Christian institution.
Now, I agree with that, and I believe you will win. My question, though, which I anticipate, is does OSHA presently have any authority over NASB, Southern Baptist Theological Seminary operation? Is there a furnace room where you've got to have OSHA hard hats on? Is there some part of the campus that is subject to the writ of OSHA?
You know, I'll defer to Ryan to answer that particularly. But the fact is, whatever is right now in place by federal law, we comply with, does not constitute an infringement of conscience on an issue in which the church does not have a position. In other words, it is an issue in which these religious liberty issues are not implicated.
And this is what I want to get to the nut of the problem, Ryan. There are some legitimate exercises of OSHA's power within institutions that are faith-based. This is not one of them, and we have to understand that that distinction is one with a great deal of difference in it.
That's exactly right. The ETS power that OSHA is attempting to exercise here is limited to addressing grave dangers in the workplace. And I think it's very difficult to argue that a virus that originated outside the workplace, a virus that is contracted primarily outside the workplace, and that oftentimes is communicated outside the workplace, is a workplace danger. It just doesn't fit within the ETS statute. It doesn't fit within OSHA's statutory powers. And I don't think that this is something that Congress ever intended to delegate to OSHA, this ability to compel employers to become the agents of the government in administering a nationwide vaccine program.
Is there any precedent where OSHA has insisted on a vaccine in the workplace?
There's only one precedent where OSHA required employers to at least make available a hepatitis vaccine, but certainly not to compel employers to compel their employees to receive a vaccine or engage in onerous and costly testing on pain of massive fines and termination. This is new territory.
It is new territory. What's the one precedent, though, Ryan? I want to be complete with people.
Certainly, OSHA has required, at least in some cases, employers who have a risk of transmissibility of hepatitis to offer the vaccine. But again, that's very different than saying you have to compel the employees to receive that vaccine. Those are apples and oranges.
100% agree with that. So, Dr. Moeller, the Fifth Circuit's already ruled in favor of a pause. What do you expect to hear from the Sixth Circuit, and when do you expect to hear it?
Well, I hope the court recognizes this as a direct threat to religious liberty and acts in order to relieve that violation by means of whatever it may choose as a way of discharging this rule. And by the way, just to make it clear, following up on what Ryan said, we offer the vaccine to our employees on the campus.
You see, that there is absolutely no precedent for this. It's not going to stand. And I believe religious employers ought not to cooperate if it indeed violates their conscience. Dr. Moeller, Ryan Bangert, thank you both. Good intro for people understanding the difference between being pro-vaccine and very anti-vaccine mandate for religious institutions. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Stay with me. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home, or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Breaking news. The United States inflation rate reached a three-decade high of 6.2% last month. I'm joined now by Jane Timken, one of six candidates for the United States Senate in Ohio, who joined me in a debate in Ohio 3 weeks ago. She did a wonderful job then. She's always a great guest. Jane Timken, welcome back to the Hugh Hewitt Show. How are you?
I'm great, Hugh. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you back. Now, I want you to go back in time with me to Columbus into that debate. What do you think happened there? How did it define the race in your view?
Well, I think it was wonderful to have you in Ohio, and we had such an incredible crowd. We had almost 1,500 people come out and hear the Senate candidates. I think the candidates define themselves. I think I proved myself as someone who is the America First candidate who can get things done and bring people together that can build a coalition of voters that can win the primary and win the general. I proved myself as someone, as you know, President Trump supported me to be chair of the Republican Party. I have been in the trenches fighting for our conservative values here in Ohio. And I'm fighting for that America First agenda that was working for Ohio. When we had energy independence, we had record low unemployment, a secure border, we were strong in foreign policy, we had a strong military. Those are the values that Ohioans want. These are the things that I'm going to be fighting for in the U.S. Senate. And I know Ohio's communities. I'm the only candidate that spent the last 5 years traveling all four corners of Ohio repeatedly. I spend time with our families and our businesses and our communities, and I know which values from Washington, D.C. they want and which ones they clearly don't. And Ohio wants a senator who's going to get things done for them, and I'm the person that can do that.
Now, Jane Timken, I wrote in a column about the debate for The Washington Post that often in races with this many candidates, the last man standing is the only woman in the race. That is an advantage. When you look up at that, six candidates there, and I say, well, there, Jane Timken is the only woman running. Have you got a sense that that is, in fact, a decent advantage in a crowded field like this?
Well, you know, it's yet to be told. I think of myself as a strong candidate, someone who has grit and grace. We've got a lot of showboaters and show horses in this race. I'm a workhorse. I'm a proven leader. And that's the reason why I have so many endorsements from Republicans across Ohio. They know me as someone who can get things done. They know me as someone who has the MAGA credentials. As I said, President Trump supported me to be the chair of the Republican Party, someone who helped the blue wave crash in Ohio in 2018 and delivered Ohio by 8.5 points for President Trump. But they also know me as someone who's going to roll up my sleeves and get things done. And that's what Ohioans want. You know, Hugh, we're hardworking, God-fearing, strong Americans, and we want to be proud patriots. We want someone who's going to deliver for Ohio.
So, Jane Timken, I also noted that I cannot imagine that President Trump would endorse anyone except you. And I don't know that he'll get involved because he hadn't gotten involved thus far. But do you agree with my assessment, given his past support for you? I can't imagine him coming in for somebody else. Can you?
I agree with you. I think that obviously President Trump knows me as someone who's delivered for him. We've got a lot of other people in this race who pretend they're the Trump warrior, but I'm the one that's actually been fighting for the America First agenda. And people in Ohio know it. They've seen me out campaigning for Republicans and for President Trump all across Ohio for the last 5 years. And they know me as someone who understands that agenda and that America First agenda. And that's what Ohioans obviously want because they voted for President Trump by 8.5 points.
Now, Jane, you are also up on television already. Would you tell people about that? Because this is actually an unprecedented race. I think it's a book. It's really one of the most interesting races I've covered in 30 years on air because you have six well-financed candidates who are all colliding with each other early. I mean, you're up on TV already.
Well, yes. And I think it's important to have a message. I was up on TV first when I announced my candidacy. We're back up on TV talking about issues that are very important to Ohioans. We are out there. My agenda is talking about no more mask mandates, putting parents first. My next ad is going to be about parents first. And I've started back in the spring a listening tour talking to parents about what's happening in our schools. You saw what happened in Virginia. I saw that happening in Ohio last spring as I was talking to parents about what was happening in their schools. The pandemic opened their eyes. And it's an example of the Democrats' continued government overreach where government first versus the people first. Republicans will always empower parents and the people to make decisions for their health care and for their children and for their lives. And that's a very powerful message.
Last question on that, Jane Timken. And thank you for joining me. Keep coming back. I'm going to interview all six candidates round robin all through the year because I think it's so fascinating. Glenn Youngkin won. So did his lieutenant governor. So did his attorney general. So did the Republicans who needed the House of Delegates on parental rights. So you're going to take a page from that playbook. Have they had the same kind of dismay with the education system in the Buckeye State that there is in the Commonwealth?
Very much so. And it's across the board. We saw and it's public and private schools in central Ohio. There's two moms that were on a crusade for transparency in the curriculum. They were just simply asking the school to tell them what they were teaching. And it's not just critical race theory. It's talking about actual learning. There's a lot of, you know, focus on gender issues and race. But parents want their kids to get a fundamental education. It's a priority of mine because it's about the American dream. We need to be educating our kids for the jobs of the future. We should be teaching long division, not division. We need to make sure that you have an educated workforce. That's a priority of mine. Ohio is a big manufacturing industrial-based state. We need to have kids that can fill those new technology jobs.
Jane Timken, thank you. Keep coming back. She's running for Senate in Ohio, one of a half dozen candidates who joined me for a debate 3 weeks ago, and they'll keep coming back.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.